From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Grammatical, Minneapolis, this is Nice Game Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark LaCroix, I too make nice games.
In this episode, we talk with Andrew Plotkin, freelance game designer and interactive fiction guru, to discuss interactive fiction communities. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start. Welcome in, Andrew. I appreciate you dancing along.
Yeah.
Even though you can't hear the music. Right.
Silent disco.
I can't hear the music, but, you know, try to join in.
Cool. I know you have a vast history of things that you have worked on. You were describing earlier that, like, you can't really just pinpoint it in one little sentence. Can you describe to listeners a little bit about yourself and what you do?
A little bit. Well, I mean, so let's go back to 1978.
Whoa.
And like the company that my father worked for had a open office day, and they brought in, like, we went in and we sat down and we looked at all the computers, which were, of course, giant, you know, honking mainframe things. And my father said, here, take a look at this. And he dropped me down in front of a teletype that was playing Colossal Cave Adventure, which was the first adventure game, to my fingers, almost the first adventure game.
Yeah.
And I was 8 years old, and I was completely fascinated. This is obviously the best thing in the universe, and I wanted to do it forever, which I couldn't because it was, you know, in an office. Right. But we eventually got an Apple, and I played more of them, and then I went to college, and I wrote some games, which I hope are nice. Actually, people describe them as nasty, but that's because they're puzzle games. Nice is not the word you want people to use when you're describing your horrific puzzle creations.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the actual subject of what I think we're talking about today is I got into the internet news group that was discussing interactive fiction and puzzle games. This was after all the commercial game companies had fallen over, right? Because in the 80s, companies like Infocom, Level 9 and so forth, sold adventure games, and then by 1990, just total wipeout. Graphical games are in, text games are out.
Yeah.
But there was this thing called the internet, and fans who were interested in playing the old games and making more of them on a non-commercial basis. And suddenly I was part of a group of people who were like talking about writing open source tools to play more of the games and write more of the games, and analyzing the old games to figure out how they worked and coming up with better schemes and expanding on the genre and doing new things. And it was really my first time in an online community that was really focused around, like, creating new stuff,
not just
a fandom, but a creative force fandom.
Right. And I think that's an important distinction, because, like, there are a lot of online communities out there. I mean, our Discord, for instance, is one. Mm-hmm. But this, the communities that we're talking about here sounds like are specifically game development focused. Like you said, creative communities, not just communities dedicated around Supernatural or whatever the heck. We're talking about specific making things. And everybody around that talking about the act of making things.
Not that there's anything wrong with Supernatural fans making things. That's called fanfic. That's like whole
right,
other
right,
communities
right,
there.
Right. Absolutely.
But yeah, so and I wouldn't say just game designers, but also, I mean, we were forming informal academic studies. We were writing reviews of old games. We were analyzing what went right and wrong about the games, where Infocom went, where Infocom didn't go, what else could be done. It turned into an entire thing, and it was really active in I joined in like 1993, 1994.
Okay.
Things got really kickstarted in 1995 when a guy named Kevin Wilson started just off the cuff an interactive fiction competition, like a competition for short games, because people had the notion that to write a game, you had to write a big, you know, multi-hour, something that could be sold in stores for $40.
Right.
And Kevin said, no, let's just like write little things and try one idea and see how it works. And this was hugely successful. I entered a game, it did pretty well in that. And then suddenly we had an annual competition suddenly because everybody wanted to do it. And the thing about short games is that if you write a game and like you can write it in a month and then people discuss it and then think about it. And the next year everyone comes back and says, hey, I thought of somewhere else to go with that. I've entered a new game. And the cycle is much faster than you expect in the commercial game industry where people spend four or five years writing a game, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So there was a lot of creative ferment and just like new ideas coming out, just specifically because of the eye of competition. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which, by the way, is still going on today.
Yeah. Oh, neat.
That's awesome.
It's interesting that you frame those communities as born after the sort of commercial interest in the genre waned. Do you think that was, those things are correlated directly? Like, that would those communities not have built up had there been an active commercial scene? Was it just sort of filling in a vacuum? Or was it just inevitable?
All of the above. It's fair to say that people were already interested in doing this stuff back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. There's a guy named Jason Dyer who is doing a project to play every single text adventure game, starting, with the earliest ones and going forward in chronological order, which is, of course, a massive project because when you start to dig into it, you realize that everybody was writing them. Most of them were tiny and small and silly. Mm-hmm. I wrote some tiny, small, silly ones when I was 14 years old. And most of them weren't preserved, but some were. And so even though people were writing commercial games at that point and selling them, and the genre was huge in stores, everybody wanted to just like do a little one and see how it worked. Write it in AppleSoft Basic, Write it on your Commodore 64, just get something out there. Mm-hmm. So the interest existed. The scene that I was in the 90s specifically came together after Infocom folded and started with reverse engineering Infocom technology. Mm-hmm. So that's something that probably wouldn't have happened if the company still existed, because there would have been some reverence towards, right, some degree of respect towards people that were still making a living from it. But after the company died and, the IP was owned by Activision, and Activision was writing some games under the Zork name, like Return to Zork, but they weren't text adventures. They were graphical adventures in a different style, and we weren't interested in that. So the idea of going back and reverse engineering the old games and playing them for free on your own machine wasn't didn't seem like a sin. Mm-hmm. Of course, we were also, in our 20s and on the internet, so we were pirating games anyway. But nonetheless, a lot of it grew out of that. I think probably if the commercial scene had remained around, people would have done some of that and then gotten into the scene and gotten into the industry and published games. A lot of the people who were in that community did, in fact, eventually get into the game industry and start writing games. Sam Barlow was in that, he's in that group. Ah. Emily Short, John Ingold, who went on to do Ingold Games. Mm-hmm. So they all very specifically say that they got their start thinking about text adventures in this community and then went off and took the idea of narrative games in different directions. It has bled out into the industry as a more, well, first into the indie world and then into game design as a field, as a thing that people practice in the real world. Mm-hmm. To the extent that you can call this the real world.
that's really interesting. I think that it sounds like a lot of creativity was born through these communities, and I imagine that a lot of that knowledge hopefully has stayed intact just due to people hopefully still being around, even in the communities themselves, maybe not necessarily in the industry itself, but I think that that aspect of community provides a lot of structure for new developers looking to create interactive fiction. Can you speak a little bit more about maybe not just the community's influence, but your influence and how that community has influenced you?
I always hesitate to position myself centrally. I've just been around for a while.
Okay, that's fair.
One of the things that I did was work on tools.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So Inform was an open source compiler created by Graham Nelson to target the Infocom format. And I wrote several games in it. And then we started to realize that the Infocom format as a virtual machine that was designed in 1979 was not modern enough for modern machines.
Sure.
Not you know, it had limits on space and limits on variables. So I experimentally designed a larger virtual machine, which the Inform compiler, the language that people were using, could also compile to, thus freeing up a lot of the space limitations. So that caught on and people started using that. And then I was involved in, you know, compiler updates, tool updates, interpreter updates. One thing I have to apologize for, I've talked about a lot of this stuff in the past. You're getting snippets of a lot of different spiels that I have.
Oh, of course.
Which are not super well organized.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about the transition from essentially modding to like bespoke tooling. Yeah. It reminds me a lot of like the earliest sort of game dev scene I was part of was modding Quake. And there was a similar inflection point where a community was built around like the thing we loved, and then being creative in that box, and then realizing that the box wasn't big enough for us. Mm-hmm. And then there are some people who, you know, went forward and, you know, made new things or just took that creativity to other venues. And then there were some people who just held on deeply to the thing we liked was the original thing.
Yeah.
Is that something that happened at that inflection point where people, that original format, people loved it so, or was everybody clamoring to expand the boundaries of it?
Well, I was, when I designed the new format, which I was primarily interested in just relieving space limitations. Mm-hmm. So I wanted the games to play exactly the same. I wanted to add, like, there was room for thinking about graphics. There was room for thinking about sound. It hadn't been very well standardized even back in Infocom's time. So I wanted to standardize that a little more, but there wasn't a whole lot of pressure. Like, there were some people who were interested in that, but there wasn't a whole lot of pressure about it. Mostly it was people saying, and I just ran out of global variables. Can you do something about that? So there weren't people holding on to the idea of 256, you know, global variables as a limit.
Right.
When we were doing this in the 90s, they were just like, hey, more space, great. More recently, just like in the past 5-10 years, there's been an interest in taking the games back to the retro platforms and saying, can we make a game that runs on a Commodore 64? Right. Not because people are excited about global variable limits, but because they were excited about the, you know, the material presentation of playing it on an original hardware. Mm-hmm. But that put back pressure on the tools, and people started saying, hey, could we go back and add some of the support for the tiny games, the very small constrained systems, into the compiler, which there kind of hadn't been in the 90s. Like, there, that nostalgia didn't crop up right away. It took a while for people to go back and think of old hardware as a space, like a specific style of playing that they wanted to get back to. Mm-hmm. So that's actually been more recent rather than happening in the old days. On the other hand, there's endless layers of this stuff, right? One thing that you can do with the text-in, text-out interface is say, well, what else can we put it on? Can we put it on IRC? Can we put it on a MUD? Can we put it on Discord? Mm-hmm. At that point, you're flattening out all the stuff about graphics and sound again. You're back to plain text. On the other hand, you're taking the same game and exposing it in a new interface to a new set of players.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the huge wins that happened about, I hate to say it's about 20 years ago now, 15, 20 years ago, because it feels like the old days, but not, I don't mean the 90s old days. I mean like the like the 2010s old days.
Yeah, sure.
Was when we were able to port the old virtual machines to JavaScript. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly all the old games were playable in a web browser, which was a tremendous expansion to getting the word out outside our community. It's the difference between saying, oh, here, you're going to play this game, download this interpreter from this site over here, get it running, make sure it matches your thing, set up the fonts, and then you can play the game, versus saying, here's the URL for my new game. Mm. It runs. That became, that was a key transformation in the way people saw everything.
It's really interesting to hear just how much the materiality has keeps coming back. It kind of reminds me of the resurgence of vinyl and people choosing to listen to music on vinyl, either because of the ritual or because they like the sound of it, you know, whether modern or legitimately, you know, vintage vinyl records. Also then, you know, they're choosing, do we listen to it on a CD or a cassette or a streaming platform? What type of file are we using? Like, audiophiles get really, really into that sort of thing because it matters more and they have the choice now, as opposed to when you listen to a vinyl record because that's what you had.
Right.
It's really interesting to hear that with more options available, they're being chosen intentionally and being challenged flexibly in that way.
Yes. So vinyl is this is an interesting side topic. Vinyl is interesting because it has become a way for, I mean, not to be terribly like economic about it, but it's a way for people to express being fans economically, right?
Mm. Yeah.
The way you can't make money streaming your music, but you can make money selling a boutique vinyl record to your fans. And this obviously shows up in games too, right? Mm.
Yeah.
So I don't want to knock down the materiality of it, but there is a whole lot of capitalism going on.
Yeah.
And
well, I think you hit on a good point, which is, I mean, a lot of people buy the vinyl record, but then they get the download code. Right. And then they just, that's how they generally listen to it. And I don't think people have a lot of illusions about that. Mm-hmm. I think, cause it's a piece of merch, right? As you describe.
Right.
But I think that's probably also true of, in games where people, they get their fancy, they get their CRTs so they can play Sega Genesis, but they actually probably mostly play Sega Genesis on an emulator on their PC rather than in the setup that they spend a lot of time building, which they do for their own sort of emotional reasons. And I think, going back to, I think, Lydia, to your observation, which is, I think people are, they yearn for context.
Yeah.
Right. And, and whether they are, whether,
that's a good way to put it,
whether they legitimately actually achieve it or not, right? They want it.
Right.
And so that materiality is something that, whether it's earnestly expressed or not, it's a desire that I think people have.
But I think it's also something that, at the very least, even if they don't want to commit to it, they want to play with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly right.
It is easier to see in interactive fiction just because it's not a hugely high profit industry, right?
Right. Right.
The material aspect is there. The economic aspect it's present, but it's not overwhelming. It's not something that everyone is going to stampede for as soon as there's a opportunity for profit. People are not like there is certainly like hardware fans out there selling Commodore 64 updates for fans, but it's not like Taylor Swift. Another thing that was going on at the time was archiving.
Yes.
The original games, the original community was organized around an FTP site. Remember FTP sites?
No.
Yeah, the youngins at this table do not, but I do.
Can you give us what the initialism means?
File transfer protocol was the way you transferred files over the internet before HTTP was invented.
Oh, okay.
And the archive got started in 1992. Web HTTP did not appear until 1993, or it didn't become a thing that people knew about. Oh. So we were downloading files using this very old protocol. We were communicating on Usenet, which was, you know, one of the first social media. It was all like mostly people at universities, because people at universities were the people who had online accounts, right? In 1992. The FTP site was hosted at a university in Germany, just because that's the first person who volunteered to like collect some files. They eventually went, like the university, like that department shut down and we moved it around. At that point, I also volunteered, like separately from the tool work, I volunteered to say, hey, I can get a thing up on this new World Wide Web that someone invented and could provide a website with the same files. So I started maintaining that, and I became like one of the long-term maintainers of the archive of everything.
Okay.
A position which I still hold.
Ah.
So at that point, I was like involved in writing games, involved in writing tools, and involved in archiving. So I was in some sense like a big walla of the community.
Yeah.
Who knew who I was. I hate to trade on that, but it has been an element of continuity, which I sort of like, I'm the one who's been around for a while.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I wrote, you know, I wrote games in the 90s. I have not written so many games since then, although I did do a Kickstarter in like 2010, which came out in 2014, which was for a large text adventure. But I have not mostly been an author since then. I've been involved in community organizing. I've been involved in starting up the nonprofit, which now supports all this stuff. And most recently, helping to start a new little conference for interactive fiction.
Neat. I think I saw the flyers for those in the expo hall, or the festival hall at GDC.
Yeah, we were sitting there showing off our nonprofit.
Neat.
Yeah, we can link to that in the show notes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you should. It is one of the things that I'm here to do is like promote the stuff.
We've got a conference
coming up. People should join. It's great. Mm-hmm. Anyway, while protesting way too much that I am not central to the community, I've actually done all these things. I also have. I think it's mostly that I've had the stubbornness to like just not drift away and do other stuff, because there's, you know, lots of people in 30 or 40 years drift in and out of the community and go off and found game companies and do other things. And I'm just like still sitting here.
Well, that continuity, it's not to be undersold, because
it's actually really important, not just me personally, but like having an archive that goes back to 1992 and that has all of the games that people have submitted to the competition since 1992 is huge. Mm-hmm. Having the forum, you know how easy it is for a forum to just like shut down because someone couldn't pay the bills, and then it's on a Discord, and then, you know,
then it's stuck there.
Discord doesn't keep the stuff. It's stuck there. It's hard to keep track of. You can't search it.
Right.
Running our own stuff, like one of the big motivations for having a nonprofit was saying we need to keep maintaining its infrastructure so that we're not just, you know, part of Facebook like everything else is, because that's just not going to last.
Apart from the historical value that keeping that continuity provides, you're in a unique position to sort of understand what the modern communities, how they've evolved from the original ones.
Yes, maybe.
Has there been a lot of generational turnover? Because I think about a lot of the excitement around Twine, for example, which to my memory and my ignorance of this area feels relatively recent. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, are other movements in interactive fiction or narrative design, how do they flow through? And were they born from this original community? Did they intersect with it? How does the relationship with this very specific history interact with the sort of adjacent areas of game dev over the years?
Right. Okay, so Twine is a good example. Chris Klimas, who invented Twine, was part of this 90s Usenet group.
Okay.
He entered games in IFComp. And like somewhere there's a photo of me and Chris Klimas and Adam Kadre, like back in the 90s. We're all babies. He had an idea for Twine, like as a more accessible, completely different, non-Zork style thing. And he just like wrote it and put it out there. And it didn't make a huge splash initially, until it was picked up by Anna Anthropy, who was a author who promoted it as a way for people who were disadvantaged people and people who didn't like grow up with computers, who did not grow up in the class of I have all the technology and can spend my free time writing games. She really wanted it to like, let me grab a book, which your readers cannot see, but Rise of the Video Game Zinesters by Anna Anthropy, which was, I think, 2011, 2012, right? Because 2012 is when I first went to GDC and met Anna and some of the other people. Mm-hmm. And she was really involved in saying game design is something that everybody can be involved in. You don't have to like be from a traditional programming background. You don't have to be a fan of the game industry or classical computer games or adventure games. You can just express yourself using this sort of thing. And that actually turned out to be huge. And yes, it was a generational shift in interactive fiction, because there were a lot of people in the old community who said, what is this nonsense? This is not a text adventure. Mm. But this was a big thing. You can actually go back and find an essay that I wrote in the 90s saying choose your own adventure games are not interactive fiction. I was very definite about this. Mm-hmm. Choice-based games are not interactive fiction because we're doing a thing and it has a history. It goes back to Infocom. It allows you to express, you know, player choice, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so that when Twine hit, there was a reaction in the community to say, we should not allow that. This is not what we're doing. Hmm. People were saying, you know, IFComp should not allow this because IFComp is for a specific kind of game. It was an argument. And I look back, several of us, fortunately, including the people who were running IFComp at the time, looked at this and said, we can grow or we can be the assholes here. What are we going to do? And over the next few years, the number of games entered in IFComp went from like 40 a year up to like 80 a year, mm-hmm. because Twine was half, two-thirds of the things being entered. And I had to go back and, you know, put a footnote on my essay saying, well, this sure aged badly, didn't it?
All right, listeners, I've challenged you on this many times. People aren't telling me that I'm wrong about stuff. And I'm wrong about a lot of things.
What is something you've recently been wrong about?
Oh, geez.
Well, that's for listeners to tell us.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
At nicegames.club/feedback.
Right.
You can tell us all about how you love the show, how Lydia's doing a great job, how Mark's keeping it together and how Steven is just so wrong about this one thing. That it just cannot hold it any longer.
I really thought more people would bite on this, but we haven't gotten a lot of feedback about that. Maybe it's just me and my argument.
I think we've cultivated too friendly a listenership.
Yeah.
Which is something that needs to change now.
We need to rebrand as the Triforce and have you be power, so that way they have to fight you at the end.
Ah, there it is. Okay, yep. Go fight the power Triforce. I don't know not about Zelda. Go to nicegames.club/feedback and let me know why I'm wrong. Well, that speaks to the efforts that go into like cultivating these communities, because like as the community ages, you'll have the quote unquote old guard that are looking to make specific things, or they've set in their ways and decided that this is what this would be like, and then there are new people coming in and they have different ideas, and some of those ideas challenge what brought the community together in the first place.
Right.
And so what you're talking about really speaks to that effort in like not just staying rigid to a specific idea, because that will stagnate your community. You'll just get stuck in that and eventually people will leave and you'll just shrink. I mean, just talking about how IF Comp has grown dramatically since then due to the fact that they've included multiple or new ideas and new concepts as to what could be interactive fiction speaks to that idea right away.
Well, there's also a logic to the changing, the evolving feelings that, and I don't mean to presume this was how you evolved your feelings on this, but I can imagine in the 90s when you wrote that essay, it felt like that tradition was still establishing itself and maybe needed to be protected in a way that when Twine came along and some of the neckbeards, were the oldies were like, no, we don't want anything new.
Yeah.
I think it was probably maybe easier to say, we've proven ourselves. We are a place in history. It no longer needs to be guarded so closely.
Right.
Is that, am I onto something there, or is that not at all how that happened?
It's hard to disentangle my own feelings.
Okay.
Right.
That's what therapy's for.
Yeah.
Not a service of the clubhouse.
Right.
No. Yes. I mean, it's certainly true that back in the days, what we wanted to prove that the stuff that we liked was special. Everybody wants that, right? And so we came up with reasons for it to be special.
Right.
Part of being a mature community is being able to analyze feelings about it and understand, yes, these are the aspects of what I felt that were special at the time, but I can also like feel about that a different way today. I can see related things happening in other things today. Mm-hmm. Knowing what to keep and what to value of what you loved is hard.
Yeah.
Especially when what you love turns out that I was rereading, this is totally off topic. I was rereading Elizabeth Sandifer's essay on Neil Gaiman and his history. Mm-hmm. Which is excellent essay. I don't know if you've run into it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a weightier evolution of thinking, but I see the connection.
Right.
Sometimes you just have to take in the new information.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. Yeah. I think we've gone over some of the history.
Yes.
And I think
in a discursive and rambling way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's an important context for the just talking about communities just generally. So, compared to those early days, what is the makeup of the sort of the modern interactive fiction community? Do you have mostly people who come in who are writers, people who are interested in games, but then maybe they don't have a lot of programming experience, so they're designers? Mm-hmm. Or do you have people who are really interested in the programming aspect, especially tool builders, and then want to find a creative outlet? Like, Or is it kind of just the generalist who's interested in this topic specifically? How has that changed over the years, or has it stayed roughly the same, the sort of the profile of the person who makes up the community?
One thing about the expansion of interactive fiction into sort of a general field of that people are aware of is that I no longer believe that I can see most of the community, mm-hmm. or most of the communities that fall under the label. As I said, we run a conference. The conference is small, like 200 people show up. I can tell you about the background of that, but it's not a very good sample. It's the people who are interested enough and who are familiar with our community and are willing to show up. So that includes, try to keep it as a sort of even mix of students and academics and people working on indie games, and people working on tools for indie games. It's not a big enough conference to attract giant company people. So it's sure. So that's a nice balance, but it's, as I say, it's just people showing up to one thing. Yeah. If I go to, like, when I go to GDC and hang out in the narrative talks, it's a different slice because it's mostly game developers, because that's the conference. Mm-hmm. Now we've got a forum. The forum is great, but the forum is descended from the same UNet group that I was talking about. So it's a lot of, it has history. It's active and people show up, but it's not a good sample either.
Yeah.
So I feel like I'm now too old to have my finger on the pulse of everything.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you see that as something that is, I mean, you don't sound that disappointed in that necessarily.
Well, I'm an introvert. I don't want to actually be centrally, socially everything.
Yeah. Do you think generally it is a healthy thing that there are essentially multiple communities that maybe don't as much interact, as opposed to sort of one central kind of like a community that is maybe growing and diversifying? Instead, you have little niches forming on their own?
It's healthy as long as we can keep some amount of contact between them.
Okay.
Yeah.
It is. I think it's important that there are people who know visual novels who hang out on the visual novel Discord and like can operate in both worlds. And there are people in the point and click adventure game world, and there's people in, you know, narrative design in the game industry who it's the going back and forth and keeping contact with the groups that I think is what's critical to stay healthy. And if my goal for the conference was to have a crossing point. Unfortunately, the problem with starting a conference in 2019 is that you are not ideally positioned in history to keep growing every year.
Yeah.
We're still, we've been smaller since COVID, and I'm not even sure that this year may even be smaller than last year, just because we're in Albany this year. Last year we were in Philadelphia, and it's harder to get to Albany, and travel has gotten harder. Everyone for international people has gotten much harder.
Yeah.
You know that story. And it's, keeping that going is difficult. So there's a giant recession. Everybody got laid off.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, even back in the day, right? Like the online communities was such an important part of the way that the IF community was growing. And I'm sure that's even more so now, an important aspect of it. That like you still feel their presence, even the way that you're describing it. I can tell that like you can still feel their presence, even if you're not necessarily as connected with them as you maybe were in the past.
Even as I'm saying this, I'm thinking, why am I talking about getting together people in person when it's so difficult nowadays? What we should be doing is reaching out to those other communities and forming more official connections,
sure,
liaisons.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to go back to the people that we talk to in the nonprofit and think about this.
Nice. I'm actually curious, because you've also mentioned as tangentially part of, but still a little other, you know, visual novels and point and click folks and narrative designers. What is the glue, the common specialness that everyone recognizes in interactive fiction that, you know, maybe the way that they, like, their main focus is manifests in a very different way than the classic text adventure games that, you know, you've held on to and cherished and archived for so long. But what is the common denominator that you all feel is special and that brings people who maybe like didn't grow up with these original games but see something special and see something meaningful in this world?
I'm going to give an answer, which is going to be, we're going to have holes in it. The answer is the writing. The narrative writing, the narrative design, the fact that people who are writers can communicate this way. It's that the part of the game, which is the writing. And the reason this has goal, as an answer, it has holes in it is, of course, there is lots of games that have no writing at all, no words. There are many extremely narrative, wordless games. We're familiar with that, and it's the same feeling. So you have to like be able to extract and say, there's no text in this game, but it's still a story. It's still writing. I understand that it's the same art that movie directors use to move you through what is happening and tell you what's going on.
Right.
It's also the case that, I mean, every game has a story, right? Mm-hmm. It's almost impossible to name a game that doesn't have a story arc. Maybe Tetris, right? But as soon as the wall falls down, then something happened, which means there's a before and an after. And if there's a before and an after, it's a story arc.
Yeah.
Many, many games, from the tiniest games to the biggest giant industry games, have lots and lots of story. And the bigger the games are, the more they feel like they need to hire writers to get something in there. And yet there is still a distinction between a game with a story in it and a story that creates a game. A game that is designed around having a story. A game that is designed around being a story. And when it's not that we want to be a purist about it, but when you start, when you lead with a story, everything in the game can express it. It can all... Every single motion that the game makes can serve narrative purpose.
Yeah.
And this is what narrative designers really want. They want to be able to have it all move around. I'm not putting this... You're nodding, so I'm glad you know what I mean, but I'm not putting it very well.
This might only make sense to me personally. The difference in the centrality, like which part of it is central, it feels very much like the difference between musical theater and opera.
Oh.
Again, this may only be meaningful to me, but with opera, the music and the libretto are the point.
Yeah.
And you can even have like non-staged or semi-staged operas that are still extremely good. Mm-hmm. Whereas in musicals, the play aspect of it is the central part, and then music comes in pretty frequently, but it is a kind of, it's an integral part, but it is the secondary thing.
Yeah, it's a, the medium is the message, right?
Yeah.
Like it's a structure and form have a lot to guide what is said and maybe not so much can be said, but maybe can be said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is centered? What is the constant?
Yeah.
And what is the foil or the additional to that?
And how is that taken on by the audience, right? So when you...
The center of gravity and the things that are moved by the center of gravity.
Yeah. Having that genre savvy, I guess, also for a developer to focus, to put that center of gravity in a particular place, and for a player to have that context going in, that can sort of prime the message, I guess. Yeah. I mean, it's all very in the air, I suppose. But like, I totally get what you mean by like, it is different. Like, depending on that focus, which isn't to say you couldn't tell a powerful story in any one of these ways,
right?
But there is something that what's different about it is interesting and is part of what is being said by it, right?
And I mean, that's probably part of why it was difficult for people to define it. Back then, when there were new community or new people were trying to join the community, and with the aspect of trying showing up,
yes.
I think that like it makes it difficult. It's difficult to define. We barely can define what a video game is, let alone interactive fiction. So,
and if you are wanting to protect something and you can't define it outside of it's this particular thing here, then it becomes a lot harder to open it up.
You really need two examples.
Yeah.
Right. I suppose that's got to be a huge value to the conference and the nonprofit and all that work of like forming and building these communities is to teach people these things and to provide these frameworks for people to, you know, have whatever boundless creativity is that they can bring to it, but to give them, chart them a path a little bit, because people have braved it previously, right?
Yeah,
and we are able to have guests who are in different related fields. Like someone comes up and talks about LARPs.
Yeah.
LARP isn't a video game, there's narrative designed in it.
Right.
Someone last year gave a talk about narrative through lines in haunted houses.
Oh, that makes so much sense. Wow. Yeah.
Which was super neat.
Yeah. Well, it definitely sounds like specifically with the community that you are in hand in building. I guess it's a lot of them, but specifically the conference. A lot of the connecting line is the narrative, as you were saying before.
Now, so when we're talking about that, there's another aspect that I thought about, mm-hmm. which is tools that can be used by a single person or a small group.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
Because as soon as that just focuses one person's idea.
Yeah.
I don't want to like say that all creativity comes from one person's vision, but when you're making a game and it's just you, you can decide everything.
Yeah.
And also, you're probably making a pretty small game. As I mentioned earlier, being able to make a small game in a year and have come back and come think about the next thing the next year is a much more creative cycle than having 500 people get together and work on a thing for 5 years and there's a money person in your face all the time because if you don't make a profit, the whole thing is going to disappear.
Yeah, yeah.
Removing that pressure and removing all the committees and just having someone say, this is what I want to do. If it falls apart, whatever, I only spent a year on it and I did it in my spare time.
Right.
There's a whole lot more flexibility for people to express themselves.
Yeah.
And the tools have been built to support that kind of flexibility.
Yes, definitely.
I've used Twine a little bit. I know RenPy is actually a really powerful engine, but a lot of people use it for visual novels, mm-hmm. but can also be used for interactive fiction mm-hmm. as well. And right. so I think a lot of these tools are designed so that they are simple for people who have never really touched code before to hit the ground running.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was a big theme you were talking about earlier with that generational shift.
Right. If someone was interested in developing their own interactive fiction community, like if they wanted to make an interactive fiction community that worked in Unity, please don't do that. Or do it, I guess. I don't know. I'm not your dad.
I mean, there are Twine and Ink plugins for Unity.
Yeah, that's true.
I have used them.
Well, also you're precluding that those communities don't exist already.
Okay, yeah.
But I think what you're driving at is like, if you see a place where you can build something,
yes.
what is step one?
Yes, yes.
That's a good question, man. Actually, no one's come across that before. How do you start up a new community? So, get some people together. Like, talk to someone who's excited about it and get excited about it.
Yeah.
Sit down, have lunch. If you're remote, like, say, hey, I should start a Discord. I know I was down on Discord as being, but, you know, Discords are easy to start and you can have people talk. Mm-hmm. Start organizing a regular thing. Say, we're going to get together on Tuesdays. We're going to get together, you know, every other night and just say what you're working on. Mm-hmm. Work on a thing and then show it off. And then ask people what they thought. And then go home and cry because they didn't get it. Work on the next thing. And having a competition worked for our community. We were pretty well established. There were already a lot of people running games.
Yeah.
We had the tools at that point. I'm not saying like start a competition right away. Do the thing that you see in a lot of these, community and game dev discords of here's your weekly challenge, here's your weekly prompt, and then talk about it afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Get more people. If you're in person, you know, have a meetup. I'm in Boston. Boston is great because there's a high nerd density and people get together and talk about things, not just in game dev. People get together and talk about the LED strip art that they're building or the, you know, 3D sculptures or live coding music or whatever. And there's a meetup for that in Boston, which is one of the reasons I live here. You know, you can start one.
Yeah. There seems to be like a bit of a balance between sort of organic gathering, right? Yeah. Like, let's just hang out and see what happens. And then like, all right, now let's actually build some structure to support and grow it.
Right.
I suppose it starts out more of the first and becomes more of the second. But I imagine you have to maintain a balance all the way through, right?
Yeah. You have to think about what you're doing the whole time. And I'm thinking about, like, when I got to Boston, some of my friends said, hey, we should get together and just talk about interactive fiction. This was like 2006, right? The online community was well established, but we didn't have an in-person community. Mm-hmm. And someone said, hey, let's just do it. Pretty soon we were meeting regularly at MIT and just like having a monthly, let's do an interactive fiction. What have you done? Here, let me show off a thing. That meetup didn't survive COVID, but you know, it turned into a Zoom meeting and now we do that. And of course, you know, when it turned into a Zoom meeting, people who were not in Boston started to show up.
And for those who know that they love writing, they know that they love narrative heavy games, but maybe haven't encountered anything that is specifically called interactive fiction, what would you say is a good few titles that they should try playing for themselves just to get a sense of, is this a community that I would want to actually try to join or find some place, or is this my cup of tea?
This is the question I'm bad at, because there was a period where I said, I'm going to play every game in every competition and I'm going to like know what's going on in the field. And inevitably I burned out on that.
Yeah, right? That's a lot.
And I burnt out on that 20 years ago and I never got back to it. So I don't know every game in the field and I don't know what to rank currently. The correct answer is, if you want to know about our community, go to ifcomp.org and look at last year's competition winners and the year before that and so forth. That will give you a good sense for what, like, people who are writing games right now, who show up at Narrowscope, people who see on the forums every day, what are they working on? And then some of it will be familiar and some of it will not be. That is to say, some of it is stuff that's percolated out into the indie field. Some of it isn't. There is dual novels and Twine games and so forth at GDC and then the Indie Game Festival and various like that. Those are all neat. Those are all in the orbit of what we're doing, even if they didn't come directly out of our community.
I want to say that I appreciate your attitude towards just people making stuff. You're just like, it's great that people are making stuff. I think that's wonderful.
It's so great.
Yeah. it's so easy to feel so jaded about making things that I feel very happy right now just hearing somebody being happy about making things. So thank you for that. I needed a little bit of that today.
Well, I mean, we can cap off the episode on some things to get excited about. Mm-hmm. So what is going on in this field, in these communities, that gets you really excited? Whether that's preservation efforts or new tooling or a particular game or sort of the vanguard of narrative technique. What's exciting you right now?
Let's see. I've gotten very excited about the... static deduction style puzzle games like Return of the Obra Dinn, Golden Idol.
Yeah. Yes.
I just played, this weekend I finished playing Murder at the Birch Tree Theater, which was terribly cute. Type Help is one, Root Trees Are Dead. So this is an area which didn't pop out of my IF community, but you can tell it's a super narrative field because what you're doing in all of these games is piecing together a story. Yeah. Are all very writing heavy, narrative heavy, not in the sense of watching a movie, because almost all of them are like individual frozen snapshots,
right.
But it's individual frozen snapshots of time that fit together into a story, and it's all about understanding the story. So it feels very much in tune with everything we've been doing, and it's great to see this, like, a brand new narrative genre get traction and take off like a rocket. It's also great that it's so very friendly to the things I've been talking about, solo devs, indie devs, people just coming up with an idea and saying, hey, I like this one, and people like it, and suddenly it's a thing. It's very, very satisfying, and the games are all, like, it's, I'm not going to say the games are all great. There's a lots of games. Many of them are great. There's a lots of great thinking happening in that field.
Yeah.
I love seeing it. I wish I knew about tool. There are several. You named Ink and Twine. Yarn Spinner is another one.
Yeah.
Artisy is a commercial one. I have always dreamed of, like, coming up with a perfect tool that would revolutionize the field, and I have not succeeded in doing this. If I knew what was wrong with all the existing tools, I would make one that fixed everything.
But yeah.
Revolutionize how is my first question. That's kind of the big ticket question, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So many use cases, and they're also, like, highly divergent. We've got our conference coming up in June. So that is Narrowscope coming up at the University at Albany in the middle of June. We will have links to that in the show notes. Other than that, I wish I could talk about, like, my day job is not in games at all and has nothing to do with any of this. I'm excited about, like, getting my roof fixed, like the gutter fell off. And
that might be beyond the scope of the podcast.
You think?
You know, sometimes game developers don't always think about the world outside of games.
It's true. So
it's important to stay, you know, grounded.
It's
that
important
there's a
to remember
there.
We have roofs.
Yeah.
Do we have fiction about the clubhouse? Does the clubhouse canonically have a roof?
Oh, that's a good question.
I mean, it takes someone to write it if you're up for it.
Whoa.
Making stuff, right?
Yeah. Well, thank you, Andrew, so much for being on. I appreciate you.
This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think we will have a bunch of stuff in the show notes. Mm-hmm. I think for a lot of game developers, this is an area they may have heard of, but don't really know like how vast resources and communities available to them are.
Yeah.
And so they might not know how interested in it they actually can be. So we'll hopefully get people started on that path. Yeah. And it was great to have you here too. I mean, I don't know a lot about this area, so I feel very excited about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. That's our show. You can find Andrew online on his blog, zarfhome.com. For show notes and additional links from today's conversation, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Discuss this episode, or others, or whatever, with your fellow listeners on Discord. Stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we'll be talking with Yuri Lowenthal about working with voice actors. That's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
Well, now I had a thought that I completely forgot.
Heck!
it's going around.
Soon you will all be as blank and pure as the sky.
Oh, man. That honestly sounds kind of nice.